What's up, guys? This is Coach Coop here with another episode of BHB Radio, coming to you live in the lab with Dr. Mike T. Nelson. Dr. Mike is somewhere between a scientist and a stand-up comedian. He's just awesome to listen to. I always look forward to it. He is going to riff out today on metabolic flexibility, aka how to heal your metabolism, how to fix your metabolism so it runs off of both carbs and fat efficiently. At-home tests you can do to test this out literally, hormetic stressors or positive good stressors, things like hot and cold therapies, how, when, and why to use them. Dr. Mike is honestly one of the most well-read individuals in the health and human performance space that I know. I'm really looking forward to introducing you guys to him. And I think there's something to learn here, whether you're an athlete, individual, weekend warrior, or everything in between. So without further ado, let's get this show on the road. Good evening, everyone. This is Coach Matt, and you are listening to Better Health and Body Radio, your source for the latest and greatest information and understanding in the world of health, nutrition, and performance, where we give you a seat at the table next to the best and the brightest minds to arm you with the information you need to optimize yourself. Join us for another exciting, thought-provoking episode of BHB Radio, starting now. All right, Dr. Mike, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. I really appreciate you having me on here. Good to chat with you.
Yeah, good to see you again. I don't think people know necessarily, but you and I connected at Paleo FX, I think back in 2016, which is also where I think, you know, Real Ketones was introduced to Keith and Michelle, the owners of Paleo FX there. So I've been following you before then, learning a ton from afar, and it's been nice to after we connected, continue that process in the future.
Yeah, it's always been good. Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. So I know who you are. I've got a tremendous amount of respect for you and your work. For people who may not, can you describe, you know, what you do and maybe how you got into doing what you're doing now?
Yeah, so right now I do kind of a bunch of different hats. I have online coaching and training. Most of the people I work with are trainers or more, I'd say, intermediate to advanced athletes of different spectrums. So I do all their nutrition, mobility, training, heart rate variability, sleep monitoring, you know, all kind of the whole gamut. And a lot of that is with higher end athletes, just consulting with their physical therapist potentially, or their doc or clinical neurologist, you know, trying to keep everything in line per se, more coordination for some athletes. And then I do some certifications. I have one on the flex diet certification, more nutrition and recovery, one on physiologic flexibility. So once you've kind of mastered exercise and nutrition and sleep, what are the kind of the next things to enhance recovery? So everything from looking at blood glucose, obviously ketones, to changes in pH and even breathing techniques, hot, cold exposure. How do you put all those things into a system to know when to use them and what does the actual research say? Because there's some really interesting stuff in that area, but I'd say a lot of what's promoted is probably not correct. imagine that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And then I teach for the Kerrig Institute in their clinical neuroscience program. I teach for Rocky Mountain University. I do an advanced athlete monitoring course for them. And yeah, some other kind of fun side projects, things here and there. And whenever I have free time, lift weird shaped objects in my garage and try to kiteboard as much as possible.
That's always one of my favorite things from your Instagram is it's like what new strongman implement or, you know, unique lift is Dr. Mike going to hit today? I've definitely learned from that too. Not even just on the academia side of things.
Yeah. So my new goal, hopefully in the next couple months, I should be pretty close. I'm going to be going traveling. So that kind of puts a kink in it, but I bought a 135-pound replica dumbbell. That's an inch replica. Obviously, the original inch is about 172 pounds. Mm. So if people imagine this just solid cast dumbbell, but the handle on it is the size of a pop can. So it's 2 3/8 inch. And I mean, given 172-pound one-hand deadlift, it's not super heavy. But when you put a 2 3/8 inch handle on it and then you don't allow anything to rotate, even just I've got a smaller one that's 100 pounds, just it's so weird because it just wants to rotate and the momentum and spin out of your hand. So yeah, so that's been what I've been playing with lately for fun.
Interesting. I'm trying to picture it. I'm just thinking like circus dumbbell.
Yeah, that's kind of what it looks like. Yeah,
that's awesome. Yeah. So in addition to all those things, you know, like you said, you wear a lot of hats. Nutritionally, right? You're someone I've respected for a while because you're someone who's really, as we just privately discussed offline, like really been about the context piece for a while. Mm-hmm. It's not like you're one of those strict ketogenic diet zealots, nor are we. We believe in the flexibility too.
Yes.
And at the same time, you're not necessarily coming from the mainstream of what gets kicked out there either on purely just only the high carb side. So do you mind unpacking sort of your thoughts on you know, that and also the metabolic flexibility too, how that fits in?
Yeah, so my bias is more geared towards metabolic flexibility because that's what I ended up doing my formal PhD work in, looking at how well your body uses fats, how well your body uses carbohydrates.
Oh, wow.
And on the fat end of the spectrum, if you have a low insulin environment, which most of the time you have to get to by reducing carbohydrates, usually to 50 grams or less total, and you run a lot of fat through the system, as your listeners probably know, you'll spit out a bunch of ketones, right? There's three different ketones that'll be kicked out by your liver. So this could be in the case of like a starvation where ketones, the ketogenic system is acting more as kind of the backup to your metabolism. Or it could be on purpose for various different reasons, potentially even therapeutic reasons. On the other end of the spectrum, you've got carbohydrate use, which if you're a speed and power athlete, like your whole goal is to throw a discus or a hammer thrower or, you know, destroy a bunch of short intervals on a rower, then you definitely want to be able to use carbohydrates to the highest end. And most people are probably somewhere in between. You know, if you're a recreational lifter and you enjoy putting oil on everything and bacon and carbohydrates are just not as interesting to you, you know, you could do longer rest periods and probably get by with a fair amount of lifting and do just fine. If you're someone who enjoys carbohydrates and you do a lot more speed and power, then, you know, having them in your diet is probably going to be beneficial. I did just a little experiment with a couple of clients where we didn't have them go ketogenic. We just had them do a little bit lower carbohydrates, and lower wasn't even, it's relatively speaking for them, they were still at like 200 grams of carbs per day. And we did a few days where we bumped them up pretty substantially to like, I think 350 in one of the cases. And the output on the exact same rower that he was doing, the same settings, same everything, he got about 50 watts more of power just by dramatically increasing carbohydrates. So for some people, that may not matter, right? That may not be their goal. So looking back at metabolic flexibility is how well do you use fats on one end? How well do you use carbohydrates on the other end? And then how well do you transition back and forth? And I think of the other byproduct there would be lactate. So if we're running a lot of fat through the system and it's a low insulin environment, kind of the wingman of fat is going to be the ketones, like we just talked about. On the other end of the spectrum for carbohydrates, if you're running glycolysis and you're just pushing a ton of carbs through the system, doing some high intensity interval training, everyone's heard of the kind of lactic acid, as it's called. So lactic acid immediately gets disassociated into lactate and hydrogen ions. So hydrogen ions are actually screwing up the local pH a little bit, or attempting to, and that is literally the burning sensation that you feel. It turns out lactate itself gets reused as a fuel. So lactate is actually a really good high energy fuel, right? Just like ketones are probably a higher energy fuel than fat themselves. And lactate can be taken up by the cardiac system, potentially the brain, other working muscles too. So metabolic flexibility in its whole, if you expand out from fat and carbohydrates, then you include the byproducts of them, which would be ketones and also lactate.
Very interesting. Now that's sort of something, and you know, I'm kind of asking and almost asking for a correction if I'm wrong here as well. Something that I/we have kind of almost touted for a while is that even though the namesake of the ketogenic diet is, you know, keto or as in ketones, most of what people are after when, like, the your average person is after when they try to the diet is they're probably looking for maybe the benefits of ketones, sure, but generally more so some of the additional fat oxidation that can come from that, aka fat burning. Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as like what most people quote unquote want out of the diet when they're considering trying it, I mean, the more important thing I would think is the metabolic flexibility, which once you kind of get that fairly efficient is harder to mess up, right? And the being in a certain state of ketosis is kind of more of a transient thing that isn't necessarily worth chasing, right? Especially now when you can get some of the other benefits from ketones, you know, exogenously, in addition to what regular, you know, here and there, regular time you do spend in some spectrum of ketosis, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's my bias too. I mean, if someone came to me, if we think back to what the, I would say the average consumer, not in a derogatory way, wants to do, and, you know, clients I've worked with in the past, it's like, okay, so what you're really telling me is you want to know what is the minimal amount of exercise and sort of nutritional intervention you can get by with and still eat pizza and drink beer once in a while.
Right.
You know, it's like, what is the kind of the minimal? If you're a high-end athlete, then it doesn't matter. You're going to do probably whatever to achieve a certain level of performance. So most people are going to be oscillating between, you know, some days of higher carbohydrate intake, some days of higher fat intake. And the more accustomed you've built up that machinery to oxidize fats and to oxidize carbohydrates, I think you're going to be better off, especially from a health standpoint. Where it gets a little bit more confusing is, of course, you know, calories still matter, but then you get into regulation of appetite and different feedback loops and things in the body. My bias is that, and there's some data to support this, although not all of it supports it, if you're better at using fat as a fuel, it's probably going to be easier for you to go periods of time, do fasting, or maybe even, you know, use like a ketogenic type supplement where you can get some benefit from ketones. And that's a way of acutely, you know, lowering your caloric intake and having it be relatively easy, right? You're not going to gnaw your arm off. You're going to feel pretty good. Everything's going to be relatively easy. On the other end of the spectrum, if you're better at using carbohydrates, I would hypothesize you're probably less likely to overeat, although that's, I'd say a little bit more tentative. So you can, in essence, get away with more things and probably have an easier time regulating your appetite, assuming you're doing some exercise and some movement or NEAT, so non-exercise activity thermogenesis, mm-hmm. just walking around, movement in general. And I think ketones are an interesting role, especially now that you can get them as a supplement, whether that's an ester or a different salt form, or, you know, like a quad salt where they're split out over different ions, that you can use them and get into a quote state of ketosis, right? Pushing up my ketones above 0.5 millimolars, kind of considered the start of ketosis, which is Jeff Volek's definition. And there is some data showing that you get an appetite suppression effect from it. It's a little bit debatable. Do you increase fat oxidation then or not? Overall, you probably do, I would say, if you're using them during a period of fasting or when you're purposely lowering calories. It is true that your body will kind of preferentially use ketones over fat, but the amount of ketones you would be taking in from a supplement is going to be generally pretty low. And I think as a bridge to, you know, having some days of kind of a modified fast, it makes it a lot more doable for most people compared to taking a period of time and really lowering carbohydrates, really increasing fat. Protein's kind of hit or miss. There's, you know, debates all over. Should it be low protein? Should it be higher protein? But moderate levels of protein. And even then, in, you know, pretty well-trained athletes and, you know, high intensity, I wouldn't say high intensity, but people who are doing a fair amount of volume of exercise, it's going to take several days to get in a pretty good state of ketosis, where now you can use a supplement and, in essence, get high levels of ketones within, you know, 20, 30 minutes. So I think it makes the, going back to metabolic flexibility, a little bit easier to get some of the benefits of ketones without necessarily having to go super hardcore and do a ketogenic diet, especially if you kind of only want and need those benefits maybe a couple days a week or whenever you need them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was, I think, very well said. You know, I've also seen some things coming, and I don't know what you think about this, but, you know, to your point about keto being the backup system, I suggest everyone listening check out Dr. Mike on Instagram. And one of your best posts, which I actually quoted and then reshared, was that keto is the backup system. And yeah. I know people in the, like, the Dr. Ray Pete and Danny Roddy, some of those guys in that kind of generative energy ethos community have talked about how they feel that, you know, perpetual states of ketosis, kind of almost in like at a chronic level, are stressful on the body. And, you know, they believe there's a certain amount of like adrenal hormones that get released and stress hormones that get released when that fatty tissue is liberated perpetually. Sort of like if your body doesn't necessarily have an immediate energy source, for example, carbohydrates, it always has to mine for its own energy, it's really important that you're able to do that, but you don't necessarily want to spend all of your time there, especially if, unless like certain demographics might do better with that, but also a lot of, you know, active people, athletes, things like that would not. Would you agree with that at all? Or what are your thoughts on that?
I would say kind of. I think the big missing factor is, are you in a caloric deficit or are you in a caloric surplus? And most people who do a ketogenic approach, even people who measure ketones and are doing it quote unquote correctly, it's easier to more likely be in a caloric deficit and not realize it. So I think that's where a lot of the additional stress comes from. I have seen a lot of additional stress in the transition period by looking at heart rate variability markers on people.
Interesting.
Even when we've, you know, guided them through it and, you know, done everything to what we think is the best, there have been a handful of people that I've seen that just, you know, 6, 8, 10 weeks into it, just still did not tolerate it well.
Yeah.
And that could be related to their training because they were a little bit more on the, you know, the weightlifting, not high end speed and power, but more towards that carbohydrate end of the spectrum. There's other people I know, like Luis and those guys from Keto Gains, who he's been doing it for a long time and, you know, does really well with it. And it definitely works for him. Obviously, very knowledgeable people and know what they're doing. And if you're in a caloric surplus, you're probably going to mitigate some of that stress on the system. And so what I have played with people is when they're transitioning, is trying as hard as possible to keep their calories a little bit higher so that we're only dealing with the stress of changing fuel systems and not additional stress of being in a caloric deficit at that time. But that's also harder because you're going to eat a lot of oil, a lot of butter, coconut oil, all those types of things. I think it does take a little bit more effort and oversight. So my bias is, if we're talking about just generally healthy people, we're looking more for performance and body comp. You know, I tell people, like, we're just going to monitor your heart rate variability. We're going to do a transition period. Maybe we might use some ketone supplements during that transition period, some C8, MCT oil. Try not to drop your calories super low and try to get you transition to more ketones. And then we're going to comparatively look at your heart rate variability, see how the markers of stress on your system are. Most people appear to do okay with that. Again, as long as their training isn't getting to be too crazy. If you're wanting to compete in the CrossFit Games and all your training is glycolytic, that's probably going to be pretty hard. But most people have the luxury of, you know, pulling out their rest periods, allowing a little bit more rest between, probably not going all the way to failure. Most people are not doing a lot of high-end speed and power. So again, I think it can definitely work. A lot of it goes back to, what are your goals? Like, what do you want to do? You know, I've had, you know, dinner several times with Dom D'Agostino, and in general, he doesn't eat a lot of carbohydrates. And I've spotted him a few times in the gym, and the dude lifts a shit ton of weight and, you know, does just fine. So you can always find people who, you know, do it and it works well for him. And if you talk to him, he's like, well, you know, it's just easier for me with my lifestyle because of work and everything else I have going on. He's like, I just find that it works better. So, hey, great. If you start getting into, you know, treatment of pathologies through your physician, you know, I think you can make an argument for going a little bit harder into ketosis and maybe staying there for a period of time, depending upon what you're doing. So my bias for most of the people I work with, you know, I have had people that have done a ketogenic approach and they just liked it and it worked well for them. I've had a few that wanted to test it out and the transition for them was just absolutely horrible. And like I said, almost 3 months in with one particular guy, his HRV was still dog crap. So no matter what we did, for whatever reason, his physiology just didn't react well to it. I would say he was generally more of the minority in my experience. And again, my bias is that state of ketosis, like you said, is more of the backup system for most people. So it's utterly fascinating to me that we can take Bob, whose butt looks like a couch cushion, doesn't really exercise much, has never been remotely close to any state of, you know, ketosis in his entire life. If we take him and assuming IRB, whatever, approve this, lock him in a metabolic chamber for 3 days or 4 days or a long enough period of time, his body would figure out a way to go into a ketogenic state. That your body, despite not ever using that metabolism much at all in his entire life, it's still keeping that around just in case food disappears. Which with even ketone supplements is fascinating that most people generally respond pretty well to them. Their body still has that ability to use ketones as fuel because we're so survival and redundant based that we're going to keep some of that machinery around. So I think, you know, running the backup system once in a while for, you know, maybe a couple of weeks or whatever, a year, maybe a month, depending upon your goals. Yeah, to me, that makes a kind of a lot of sense. And then the rest of the time, you know, what works best for you in terms of your goals, your performance and your lifestyle and kind of adjust accordingly from there.
Yeah, that's pretty well said. I think Dr. Brian Walsh, I've heard say things along those lines, like, you know, follow a strict ketogenic diet for a period of time or maybe go through a period of time of more rigorous or perpetual fasting. And then he sort of, I believe, thinks along the same lines as you there. In addition to that, too, I would think that there could kind of be a case to be made. There's a case to be made between like different types of like fast twitch athletes, right? Like obviously no one is one muscle fiber type as far as the composition of their muscle mass. But, you know, more of like a general weightlifter who you're going to see in the gym is going to have probably more of like the type 2A fast twitch muscle fiber, which is fed both kind of oxidatively or with fat and then also glycolytically, versus like, you know, I think you mentioned like CrossFit Games athletes, maybe Oli lifters, like, you know, hairline trigger level, let's say speed and power, like a basketball player, like those guys are probably going to need a bit more carbohydrates because the type 2B fast twitch fibers are much more, I think, just purely glycolytic or carb driven, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a component of it. I guess if you would have asked me like 4 years ago, I would have said that's probably the main driver. Boof. Now I'm not so sure. I mean, I think it's definitely a factor. The hard part is the amount of biopsy data, like if you talk to like Dr. Andy Galpin and those guys,
yeah.
The amount of biopsy data we have in elite athletes is just, it's just so limited. And then the more work I've kind of done with metabolic hearts and especially with the Moxie device, you just see different things, right? You just see like high end, like super speed and power athletes. They can literally contract enough muscle fiber to almost arterially occlude the muscle for a short period of time. You know, the average person walking off the street, even most probably trained people, probably not so much. All right. So that's probably a benefit to someone who is doing, you know, a 1RM or Olympic weightlifter or something like that. You know, I've talked to Evan at Training Think Tank and obviously Aaron Davis and those guys down in Austin and Pat Estes and Ben House and my buddy James Serby. And we've had these endless discussions about, is it really a fiber type? Is it more looking at Moxie, how the recruitment pattern is, right? So if you've got someone who is a CrossFit Games athlete, obviously take someone like Matt Fraser, who's, you know, been dominating it till he retired. Really strong person, huge history of Olympic weightlifting, but you know, he wasn't really the best Olympic weightlifter, which probably made him ironically better for CrossFit. Mm-hmm. Right. And I don't know, I haven't seen any testing on, you know, what he's done, but the athletes who tend to really contract all the muscle and that's kind of their main go-to can create a lot of speed and power, but now you've actually started killing blood flow into the muscle, right? Or if you've got some venous occlusion, how much blood can leave, that's not going to be very good if you've got to do a marathon on the rower, right? Mm-hmm. So I think you get into it, it's kind of messy. So you've got the recruitment factors, as you know, from the nervous system. That's going to then impact just delivery to and out of the muscle. You've got the actual fiber type of the muscle. You've got the size of it. You've got capitalization. How well can you deal with waste products? And yeah, it's one of those things we'll probably spend the, you know, next several lifetimes just trying to figure out.
Yeah, I agree.
Which makes it interesting, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, more reason for, you know, people like us to stay in the trenches and, you know, kind of let our curiosity guide us. And you're right. Yeah. I mean, I realize now my question sounded a little myopic. I do realize these other things are at play.
Factor, right? And that's the hard part. We can't point to, like, you know, a meta-analysis of biopsy data from elite 100-meter sprinters to be like, oh yeah, this is the fiber type you want, you know? And even stuff like genetic testing, it's fascinating area, but unless you're using it maybe as a screening tool, you know, ethics aside, right, whatever. Yeah. For most people though, it says, okay, if you have a high propensity for this particular type of muscle fiber, great, maybe that's good. But if you have less propensity for it, but your goal is to be a 100-meter sprinter, would I really train those two athletes different? I don't know.
Right. That's, you know? Yeah, exactly. Right. It's, you're focusing more on the epigenetic inputs at that point. And it's not like, anyways, I'm with you. It's,
yeah,
you don't want to major in the minors kind of thing, right? Like what level of difference is this going to make if I figure this thing out? I mean, you could even take that last line and, you know, extrapolate it to a lot of different situations where people get caught up sort of missing the forest because they're looking at the trees.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think of all the, you know, in-depth biomechanics stuff that was published in, you know, peer-reviewed literature for, you know, what is the ideal biomechanics for a 100-meter sprinter. And, you know, it was kind of more, looks a little bit more like Carl Lewis, not super tall, you know. And then Usain Bolt shows up and everyone's like, whoa, wait a minute. Oh, this doesn't really fit our archetype we thought. And then several years pass and now they're trying to find people that, you know, look more like him. Mm-hmm. You know, just because he's been so dominant in the field. So I always find it interesting how we were pretty sure of one thing and then something happens. We're like, uh-oh, not so sure of that. And then we go in the other direction.
Yeah, exactly, man. I'm with you. You actually said something kind of interesting too on the previous loop about spending some time in ketosis as well. What do you think about kind of eating for... I mean, there's, again, we just spoke upon it. There's a lot of factors at play here, but what do you think about doing things like calorie cycling where you're eating lower calories on a day where you're at rest, higher calories on a day where you're, let's say, doing something like sprinting or weight training. And then also at the same time, kind of cycling macronutrients based on what your energy system needs are. So for example, if you're doing something that might be, and obviously this can vary based on how stressed a person is, how they breathe, things like that. But let's say you're doing some lower level, quote unquote, aerobic dominant stuff like walking the dog or something you would like to see aerobic dominant. That would be a better day for like maybe more lipolysis and thus lower carb, higher fat. And then maybe on a day of, let's say, Olympic weightlifting or something like that or sprinting, it might be better to do higher carb. What do you think about that as sort of a concept?
Yeah, I generally agree. And I would say with most clients, that are more advanced, we probably get to something that looks like that. So initially, I'm just going to do, you know, assuming I don't have any measurements from them because most of my clients are online. I'm going to do 7 days, just log everything you eat and drink. Don't impress me. And then we're going to track body weight. Just get on the scale after you use the bathroom. And we're going to track body weight each day. And I know because they're logging, they're going to change stuff. It's just how humans work. But after a week, that's going to give me a rough idea. Are you gaining weight? Are you losing weight? Are you staying about weight stable? And then most of the time, assuming that it's a more advanced athlete, they're doing more of a macro-based approach, not necessarily a habit-based approach. I'm going to set them at what I call flat macros, like the same thing every day for each day. We're going to ride that as long as we possibly can. And then usually get to the point where most people have some body composition goal also, right? They're either competing in a weight class or they just want to look better in the mirror. Doesn't matter. All those are valid reasons. And then it gets a little bit trickier. So now you're like, okay, so now we got to find a way to try to increase performance, but we can't just, you know, add 10 pounds onto you, just tell you to eat everything in sight and don't worry about it. And I think at that position, then I look at something called either macro matching or what I call macro mismatching. So a macro matching perspective, which is what I talk about in the Flex Diet, is more of a use stress model. So it's kind of stress that we can generally recover from. So I'm going to have more carbohydrates, like you said, on the days that are more weight training, kind of carbohydrate is the main fuel. I'm going to try to match the fuel to the work being done. Right? There's been a lot of published literature on this, looking up like periodized nutrition concepts. Like we were talking about, like kind of a zigzag method. I mean, that that probably goes back, what, it's like 3 decades now, you know? So a lot of this stuff has been around for quite a while. And then on days, like I usually run a standard template, it varies, but like Monday, Wednesday, Friday, maybe Saturday, a little bit more of the weightlifting, you know, kind of more your glycolytic-y type stuff. And then Tuesday, Thursday, maybe Sunday, depending on the athlete, depending on what's going on. Generally more aerobic-based development. And on those aerobic-based development, unless they're doing intervals, the intervals I'll normally put on the other days, but the aerobic-based stuff, we want to use fat as the main fuel. We don't need to use carbohydrates per se. We can, but I want them to use fat to the highest potential that we can and then have kind of a hard switch over to carbohydrates. To me, that also confers some benefits of health because your fat oxidation is going to be higher, probably going to be a more robust athlete, and you're going to be less sensitive to influxes in carbohydrates, especially in longer events. And with those, I'll usually put their training first thing in the morning because I also want them to do a little bit of it in a fasted condition of glycogen in the liver. So overnight, your liver is going to give up most of its glycogen to try to keep blood glucose nice and stable. So in the morning, before you haven't eaten anything, unless you're doing shots of olive oil or something crazy, you're going to be in a low insulin state. Your liver glycogen is going to be relatively low, and that's going to confer more fat being used as a fuel in terms of a percentage. Your muscle glycogen isn't really going to be tapped that much. That's generally only tapped by the amount of work that's being done. So even 48 hours into a fast, if you're not lifting or doing a lot of muscular work, muscle glycogen actually stays around pretty good. So that's where I would start. Most of the time, the training days that strength-based are going to be higher carbohydrates. The other days are going to be a little bit lower. If I'm doing a longer fast, which I will do quite frequently, then I'll pick either that Tuesday or Thursday, and they'll work up to a 19 to 24-hour fast on that day. I found what the benefit of that is they're lower intensity. So they don't necessarily, like you said, need high amounts of glycogen around. With fasting, there's no change in what's called a PDH enzyme, so pyruvate dehydrogenase. So if I tried to do a hardcore ketogenic day, let's say Thursday, one, I have a little bit more calories coming in. Two, like we talked about, it's probably going to be a pretty hard switch. They're probably not going to get in a state of ketosis. However, I could do some fasting. You know, I can get fancy and play around with, you know, some type of ketones if we're really trying to push that adaptation, or they have a harder time just from appetite and we're limited on time in terms of adaptations. So we can do something like that where the caloric intake is also very low. So now I've kind of slashed out like one day of calories also. And like we mentioned before, I can come back the next day and have a high amount of carbohydrates, because with fasting, the PDH enzyme doesn't really seem to change that much. So the PDH enzyme is kind of like your gatekeeper to glycolysis or carbohydrate use. We know that if someone has been on a ketogenic diet for a long period of time, one of the downsides is if you dramatically give them just a whole bunch of carbohydrates, let's say the day before a race, their muscle glycogen levels will actually be pretty good, but their ability to access those carbohydrates to 100% of their carbohydrate metabolism is actually damped down by, you know, like 3 to 8%. That's because that PDH enzyme, that kind of gatekeeper to carbohydrate metabolism, doesn't bounce back within a couple of days. You know, it takes a couple of days, a couple of weeks, it takes a period of time, and it definitely does come back, but not right away. So with fasting, I can get a pretty low intake. I don't have to worry about a change in that enzyme, and I can come back the next day with a fair amount of carbohydrates with their higher training volume. After that, if you have advanced athletes and it's an off season and they've kind of plateaued, you can do a, what I call, macro mismatching approach. This would be a distress training. So with this, you're gonna, some of the literature would say like, train high, sleep low. There's different ways of manipulating carbohydrate intake, but now we're also going to look at manipulating liver intake, or stores, I should say. And then we're also going to look at depleting muscle glycogen also. So what that looks like is you come in, you do some really exhaustive glycogen depletion training, which anyone who's ever done that, it's absolutely freaking horrible. It's no fun. You can only get glycogen stores down to maybe 30, 40%. You can't drain them all the way down, but you can get them pretty low. And then the athlete would mainly have, you know, protein, a few veggies at night. So they're going to sleep on what's called a low condition. So low liver glycogen, low muscle glycogen. They'll come back the next morning and they'll not have any food, or at least no carbohydrates, and do some type of training then, usually more moderate, lower intensity training. So now that training session the next morning is done on both low stores of liver glycogen and also low stores of muscle glycogen. The caveat to that is we do see a lot of upregulation of these enzymes that are controlling carbohydrate metabolism. They do go quite a bit higher. The jury's still out on, does that actually confer a performance benefit when we go back to kind of macro matching again? So we've seen changes in molecular adaptation, but that doesn't always translate into performance. Some of the studies show pretty radical changes in performance, like Marquette in 2016. Gale, which was, I think, the year after, tried to repeat a similar study, not exactly the same, didn't see a lot of benefits. So some athletes appear to respond quite well to it, others don't. The downside is you have to be pretty careful with it and monitor stress levels, because it is very stressful. Most of the time it's done for a very short period of time. The Marquette study was only 3 weeks, but in that time they saw changes in body comp and they saw changes in performance, and they used two different groups. One basically did that similar approach. The other group did not. And they left them on the same calories and macronutrients too, which is fascinating. So I think if you're a very advanced athlete, is the off season, you may try to hedge your bets a little bit on the adaptations to exercise and see if that confers a benefit when you kind of go back into your fueled training again. Most people will probably never really get to that point. But like we said, the intermediate, I think, is just going for a walk, doing some low aerobic based building, fasted in the morning, I think, is a benefit, or on a day that you're doing lower calories. And that would be for athletes who are riding that tightrope of performance and body comp at like the same time.
Hmm. Okay, interesting. And I've got a couple, I want to be respectful of your time. I got a couple
Yeah,
things
no worries.
I want to hit on after this. What were you having the athletes do, or what are they having the athletes do for the glycogen depletion workouts?
If I remember right, I think the Marquette one was using a bike, I think. And then I believe they're looking at running economy also. A lot of times, and honestly, it's just what the lab has for equipment. And biking for a lot of measurements is usually going to be easier. A lot of times you can use a treadmill, that kind of stuff too. Yeah, but you can use anything. The hard part in practice is without a muscle biopsy, you don't really know where you're at. And I think that's where you can look up like MPRE, what is it, the theory for the work involved. I think I slaughtered that title, but he lays out a really good theoretical approach. And one of the big issues is, okay, even if I standardize the work, I standardize the nutrition, just because of recycling of maybe intermediates, just the athlete's underlying physiology, that the mechanical efficiency of what they're doing, that you may not deplete glycogen levels down the same in every single athlete in the study. So now you're left with, okay, is it we need to hit maybe that 40 or 50% of muscle glycogen to trigger more positive adaptations? Do we need to hit 30% reduction? Nobody really knows. And then there's all different types of setups between how long do we leave them there? How hard do we push them the next day, right? And there's just so many moving variables with it that we probably won't have a solid answer for quite a while. So in practice, what I would have people do is standardize your macronutrients, standardize the amount of work that you're doing in that kind of depleted state, have some marker of stress like heart rate variability, heart rate during the exercise, RPE, and you're probably gonna have to run it a few times over, a couple of years to really know if it's being beneficial or not. But if you're an advanced athlete, I think running it for a couple of weeks in the off season, worst case, maybe you lose a couple, weeks of training. Potentially, maybe it's really beneficial. The last caveat with that too is know kind of your own threshold of how far you can push your body and your nervous system and still recover. Right, because anytime you go that far, you don't want it to cost you another 3 weeks on the other side because you just tanked your system and your immune system went to crap and you got sick. Right. So you're kind of really riding the fine line there with changes and just kind of how far to push it.
Yeah, I feel you. Thanks for elaborating on that.
Yeah.
A couple things too, just while we're on the subject of metabolic flexibility and the various rabbit holes that came from that. You used to, I've heard you, I think before, give out some almost like at-home tests advice that you
Yeah.
have people do to sort of identify how well they do oxidize or use carbs and fat. Would you mind kind of unpacking that a little bit so that if people wanted to kind of just test themselves at home, they could?
Yeah, no worries. That's the tricky part because when I was looking at it, I'm like, okay. So in when I was doing my PhD at the University of Minnesota, we had metabolic carts that were about, $40,000, $50,000. So we could put these people in a lab condition and we can see exactly breath by breath, like how much fat and how much carbohydrates are they're using. Most people don't have that. I mean, I have a PNOE, a metabolic cart here and a Moxie setup and stuff, but most people aren't going to spend several thousand dollars on that type of equipment.
No.
There's some other intermediate stuff that's showing up on the market that might be useful.
Oh.
So I was like, okay, so if there is no equipment involved, like what is kind of a rough field test that people could do? On the low end of the spectrum, what I came up with is just a longer period of fasting. We know that when you're fasting, insulin's going lower. It's going to push your body to increase fat metabolism. The downside is that even healthy recreational people, how well they use fat in this fasted or even under low intensity moderate exercise is super variable. right? So I did a study that was published on this. Gadecki did one study. Helges did one study. And they showed that how well your body uses fat during rest and at low intensity exercise varies from around 23 to 93%. And these are just, you know, recreationally healthy people. They just kind of picked off the street and college age students, not high end athletes per se. But what that means is some people are really, really good at using fat. Other people, not so much. So what I use as a rough proxy is if you can do around a 19 to 24 hour fast, my hypothesis is that you're probably pretty good at using fat as the main fuel. If that feels incredibly difficult and you get very symptomatic, you just feel cranky and hangry and all those kind of things, you probably want to work on that a little bit. On the other end of the carbohydrate end of the spectrum, I'm like, okay, so what is like a high amount of carbohydrates in an extremely highly processed food that pretty much anyone could find anywhere? Oh, Pop-Tarts. So can you have two Pop-Tarts, which is, you know, just under 80 grams of almost glucose and some weird ceramic frosting on them that not sure why it doesn't melt in the toaster. However, I have found that if you get your toaster hot enough, it can melt and catch on fire. So be careful with that.
Nice.
Yeah. So if you have two Pop-Tarts for breakfast, if you want to take an insulin-induced nap in about 30 minutes, probably not so good at using carbohydrates. If you feel pretty good, you're like, that's fine, whatever. Probably okay. If you want to add a little bit of technology to it, you can then measure blood glucose under those two different conditions. And like I said, there's some other potential devices on the market that, you know, may give you an idea with that for measuring acetone levels in breath through like lumens trying to measure CO2 output.
Mm-hmm.
But without any technology, I found that those two things tend to be, it's anecdotal, but, you know, relatively reliable and give you also something you can then retest. So you're like, okay, wow, my carbohydrate metabolism appears to suck really bad. Maybe I should do more, you know, weight training, add a few intervals, get some more movement during the day, you know, because a lot of that can be non-insulin mediated uptake also. And I'm going to do this for a period of 8 weeks. And then I'm going to kind of retest myself a couple times after that and see how it goes. Obviously, sleep can be a massive effect on both ends of the spectrum too. But it allows you a way to do an intervention and then allows you a way to kind of retest each end of the spectrum.
Right, right. Yeah, that's great. That's awesome. I'm actually going to hang on to some of that stuff myself.
Nice.
Speaking of that, two last things. I did want to ask, so when you're having people do their longer fast before they follow it with a subsequent high carb day, is that like a OMAD or one meal a day fast where you're basically consolidating their full days worth of calories into that one meal when they break the 24 hour fast, or are you slashing some calories on that day when they're breaking their prolonged fast?
Yeah. So for most people, it'll be just what I call more of a pure fast, meaning that they don't consume anything that has calories. And usually with people, it's going to take 6 to 8 weeks if they're not used to it to work up to a single 19 to 24 hour fast. So I tried doing fasting, God, when like Brad Pilon's book, I think came out, like was 10 mm-hmm. or 11 years ago now, something like that.
Yeah.
And I was one of those people that had to set his watch for, you know, eat every 3 hours for like 4 years just to gain any weight.
Yeah.
And I had been used to eating every 3 hours when I was awake for many, many years by that point. And I initially heard about fasting and I was like, this is the stupidest idea ever. This is dumb. And at the same time, I was looking at research on metabolic flexibility and I'm like, okay, well, excluding exercise, how would I upregulate the use of fat in someone, you know, without drugs or anything else? What I came up with is, just don't eat for a period of time, right?
What a novel idea.
What a novel idea, you know? It's like, that'll drive insulin levels to pretty low within 16 to 18 hours. They kind of bottom out in healthy people. So whatever a benefit of having a low insulin environment combined with no calories, that would be the maximum amount of sort of, you know, stimulus I could get from it. And around that time, I started reading some of Brad's stuff. So another buddy of mine was big into it. And I'm like, okay, I've done enough reading now for 8 months. I'm convinced that this is probably going to be okay, but I've never done it. So I like doing stuff first before I have any clients do it.
Sure.
Decided to do a fast when I was doing some training in Arizona. I made it to about noon the next day and ran across the street and was at a Chinese buffet for like 3 hours. I'm like, God, this is a horrible idea. This is the dumbest thing I've ever done. I was just so hungry. I felt horrible. I couldn't get anything done. And of course, I'm not so bright. So I tried that again 2 weeks after it, you know, same thing happened. And I'm like, man, this fasting thing on paper looks amazing, but it's so stupid in practice. And then I'm like, oh, wait a minute, what am I doing? You know, it's like, I've been used to eating every couple hours when I'm awake other than sleep. Oh, maybe I should only try for like 4 hours after I get up in the morning instead of trying to go like all day and having a breakdown. Be like if someone came to the garage gym and has never trained before, it's like, yeah, you're going to deadlift and let's just put four plates on each end and 405 and I'll just yell at you. If you can't do it, just try harder, you know, unless you're Andy Bolton or somebody is just not coming up on your first rep. But I'm like, oh, so I could just, you know, put 135 on. We could put bumpers with 95. You could use the bar. You could use 225. It doesn't matter. We can scale it to whatever your current ability is. So I'm like, oh, so I probably need to scale my fasting, you know, down in a similar fashion. And, you know, over just progressing it out just one day a week by just a couple hours. Within 6 weeks, it was pretty easy to do 19 to 24 hour fast. I tried it on a few clients after that, and it seemed to go pretty good. So if someone is not used to it, I'll take like, let's say Tuesday is their fasting day. Okay, your first day, let's just get 12 hours, right? So they'll finish dinner and let's say dinner is at 8 p.m. Okay, eat breakfast at 8 a.m., right? So that's 12 hours. The following week, push your breakfast to 10 a.m., okay? Following week, skip breakfast or replace breakfast with your lunch, right? But just flip the two. Because for whatever reason, some people love their breakfast. And if I told them to skip breakfast, they got mad at me. Mm-hmm. If I told them, okay, take your breakfast and eat it instead of your lunch, they're like, oh, this is great. So weird, but it worked. So now you're at, you know, about 16 hours, right? And I found within about 6 to 8 weeks, most people could hit a single 19 to 24 hour fast relatively easy. Most people I find because of they have a job, they have a life, that even a 24 hour fast wasn't too bad once their physiology was accustomed to it. So they could have dinner with their family on Monday night. They skip breakfast in the morning, go to work, work all day, just drink some fluid, electrolytes, and come home and they could have an evening dinner with their family again. So it also socially felt pretty good and a little bit easier on that. And then I'm also trying to get a low insulin environment. And I'm also trying to whack out a whole bunch of calories at the same time. So I also got this from Brad Pilon is when you have your dinner, it should be just the same thing that you would normally eat. You know, don't try to make up for it. Don't try to do anything different. And clients, I'll have them report, okay, how long was your fast? How did you feel? And what was your first meal after? And if their first meal after is like three times their normal size, I'm like, yeah, let's back up your fasting a little bit. I think you probably went a little bit too hard, right? Because you get all those type A people that are like, ah, screw you. I can do this 24 hours. Ah, here I go. And they just tend to eat everything in sight like I did afterwards. It's like, no, let's back up. Let's just give your body a couple of weeks to get used to it. And it'll be a little bit easier at that point.
Got it. I appreciate you diving into that a bit more.
Yeah, no worries.
I think the last thing that I wanted to talk about was, you know, we got into a bit of, and it's obviously out there, right, with exogenous ketones and, you know, how they help things like performance and so on and so forth. It sounded like when we were talking offline that you're doing some work looking at them with regards to their impact on neurological health, specifically brain injuries. Is that right?
Yeah. So I'm a associate professor for the Carrig Institute. The Carrig Institute does a lot of clinical neurology and I've done work for them on both the professional level and also as a patient. So I've gone to my buddy, Dr. Jeremy Schmoe's clinic here. The short version is I only currently see in monovision. So when I was a kid, I had what's called a lazy eye. So lazy eye back then, 1978, I was 4 years old. They put a patch on the other eye to make your quote unquote bad eye work more. And my eyes would then track together. And they're like, oh, great, you're healed. Woohoo. I'm like, okay. Before that, I actually saw in double vision. So when I went to the doc, my parents told me that they held up this little dog, you know, I don't know how many feet away. And they're like, well, how many of these dogs do you see? And I guess I told them, well, two, but only one of them's real. Because when you interact with your environment, you learn right away via proprioception what's the real image and what's the false image. But visually, I was seeing two images because my right eye sits up and out a little bit too far. The images go to the visual processing part of the brain, and you get an image from each eye. Your eyes are offset a little bit in your face, and those images then are fused together, which creates 3D by the brain. In my case, because the images were so skewed, I couldn't fuse them together. They were too far apart. So I ended up seeing in double vision. So fast forward to doing, you know, a whole bunch of stuff, never really thought about it again. And I started doing some training at the time through Z Health, and we're doing some of their visual training. This is back maybe 10, 12 years ago now. And everyone's like, hey, you got to come test this guy's eyes. Look at this crazy shit going on. So everyone starts testing my eyes. I'm getting all these really weird responses. And I remember talking to Dr. Cobb about it. It's like, oh, you know, what was your history and stuff? And it's like, oh, I'm like, oh, I hate ball sports. Like, I thought I was just not athletically developed. I thought, you know, some kids just get hit in the face with balls. That's just their life. And that was me. Turns out that's not normal. Yeah, some people are more athletic than others, but it's very, if you are not athletic at all as a kid, like something's missing. Like if you're, you know, 2-3 standard deviations below everybody else, like something's going on. So I've been working on that stuff. So fast forward through the Carrig Institute. So what I did with like Dr. Schmo's clinic is they look with a lot of like, so TBI and neurologic issues. They can do a bunch of testing related to eye movement, vestibular input, the kind of the balance canals in the inner ear, proprioception, like where your limbs are in space. And they'll do a bunch of in-depth testing and be like, okay, you had a severe impact to your head. We think maybe you have a TBI, but every TBI, so traumatic brain injury, can be a little bit different depending upon the mechanism, what happens, what area got damaged. And by looking at these different functions, I can get an idea of, oh, this function here, not working so well, this coincides with this pathway in the brain. Okay, can we find something else that you can do that will also similarly train that part of the brain? So in my case, I did a whole week at Dr. Schmo's clinic here last June. And when they tested me, when my eyes would do, they have a high speed, basically like photography video on it. And when I would look to the right for a split second, my eyes, especially my right eye, would torque. So it would like just rotate for a split second. So normally when you look to your right, your eyes should not torque. But the reason they were torquing is because if you bend your head, so if I take my right ear and bring it towards my shoulder, if you watch someone's eyes, they stay in the middle of their head. And if I rotate my head real fast, my eyes stay in the middle of my head, something called VOR, visual ocular reflex. In my case, when I moved my eyes just to the right with keeping my head still, the circuitry in my brain thought for a split second, ooh, he's tilting his head. We must kind of align the eyes better. But that was actually an error in the system. So even though it was a visual thing that they saw, I did a lot of vestibular training along with a bunch of other hand-eye coordination stuff. So they have a gyrostim there, which looks like this big kind of carnival ride they put you in, and it can spin you around in like all three different 3D axes, right? So you could, you know, pitch, yaw, tilt, all these things. So what that's doing is that's giving my brain this massive amount of vestibular input. Obviously, you still have eye input. I'm trying to hit little targets with a laser in there. And they did a bunch of other stuff too. And by Thursday, so I was there for three sessions a day. So literally like 4 days later, like almost 12 sessions later, when I looked to the right, my eyes did not do that torquing thing anymore. Mm. So they changed the interpretation of the brain saying, oh yeah, this is good. The vestibular system, everything is working the way that it should. So if we go all the way back to what happens potentially in a TBI and how ketones and other things can be beneficial, is if you get hit in the head, you have a TBI, there's two really main things that happen. One is that your normal glucose metabolism just gets really screwed up. So you have this massive energy crisis going on in the brain. You also have a lot of neuroinflammation that happens at the same time. Ketones potentially can be useful. There's a lot of animal data on this. There's a couple really early human trials that literally just came out later last year. And ketones serve a super interesting principle where they can cross a blood-brain barrier. They can serve to provide energy. So glucose metabolism is still hosed up, but the ketone metabolism appears to still be intact, right? Kind of being that backup system. So they can provide fuel for the brain and for the neurons to do work. And the ketones themselves, like Dom D'Agostino's talked about this, my buddy Dr. Tommy Wood, I interviewed both of them. They also have very interesting properties where they may directly affect neuroinflammation. They serve signaling different effects in the brain. So ketones appear to serve to help with the energy crisis issue and potentially help with neuroinflammation. So in theory, this all sounds good, but getting most people to do a ketogenic diet, it might be kind of tricky. You know, some people would obviously do it, but now that you have ketones as a supplement, whether that's an ester, a salt, a combination, right? So a salt plus MCT oil, you can get a little bit higher levels of ketones. Perhaps giving people a supplement before they maybe do some intensive, you know, neurology work, you can temporarily increase energy levels in the brain. You can also help with the neuroinflammation, and they act within such a short action, you know, 20, 30 minutes, that it becomes very practical as a more intervention to try to treat a pathology via different physicians. So to me, I think that's like super fascinating, because if you talk to a lot of, you know, clinical neurologists that do a lot of this work and, you know, patients they work with, especially TBI, one of the limiters is, in addition to them being very sensitive to, you know, stimulation and everything else going on, they just get really, really tired, right? Because if your brain doesn't have the right amount of energy, that system is goofed up. So it's not like you can give them a whole bunch of carbohydrates and have it work. That may actually potentially make it worse. Now, if we can give them an alternate fuel to provide energy, now they could do more of the therapeutic work that they need to do to try to get all those circuits kind of working better again.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting.
Yeah, super fascinating. And the last part too is that we don't have a ton of data showing that it's beneficial. We do have some data showing that it's pretty well tolerated, but we've got, you know, hundreds of years of people doing different types of ketogenic diets showing that there's not really much of a downside to them, right? So if you're a clinical neurologist trying to decide what is best for your patients, you're always going to look at what is the potential downside, which we know in this case is probably, there's a few things, but it's relatively known and very small. We don't entirely know what is the potential upside, but, you know, for me, I actually carry little ketone esters in my kiteboarding bag. So if I get dropped on my head 20 feet out of the sky, for me personally, I'm going to put myself in a state of ketosis as fast as I can. And I'm probably going to fast and I'll transition into a ketogenic diet.
Right.
Because I feel pretty comfortable that there's not much of a downside. I don't know what the potential upside is, but there's a fair amount of physiology and theory and some early work showing that it should be beneficial. Worst case, I'm not really going to make myself any worse than what I was before. So I'll kind of hedge my bets in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Dom, actually, I heard on, I think, I don't know if it was Sigma Nutrition, or he was on he was on a show that was geared a little more towards athletes, in this case, MMA athletes, although this applies to everyone. And he was sort of saying, like, you know, things along the lines of, well, you know, these, you know, exogenous ketones are, they're nudging your neurological, and he felt they were nudging your neurological and brain health in the right direction. And then that was sort of like what led him to say, all right, let's not think in silos here. Let's see what it can do for, you know, TBIs, concussions, like things like that. And, you know, I think, you know, he would like to see some iteration of, you know, fasting, exogenous ketones involved in some of the, you know, the NFLs and other places, concussion protocols is, or at the very least, like, you know, get more data on it. But anyway.
Yeah. I mean, that gets into a whole area. I've talked to Dom about this years ago. Like, one of our first conversations was, I mean, I tried some of the early ketone esters from his lab, actually, which was scary as hell. It tastes like freaking jet fuel. I thought some guy was trying to catfish poison me. But yeah, it's like, okay, so at what point do we accumulate enough data, if all the data keeps going the same direction, which it may not, that if you're the NFL or the NHL or whatever body, MMA, you're allowing other humans to run full speed into another human, you know, you have a risk of concussions and CTE and all these things. At what point do we have enough data to say that giving them massive amounts of glucose before and after that is detrimental, you know? Or do you say, okay, maybe prophylactically you're gonna have ketones before you go play because you're a running back, you know, or you're an MMA, you've got a very scheduled fight where some other human's gonna try to knock your head off, you know? What, at what point do we have enough data to say we're pretty comfortable with the downside, when it's looking like, because these are becoming such an issue, that we have to do something, and the thing that we're doing now may actually be detrimental?
Absolutely makes sense. Now, Dr. Mike, I want to be respectful of your time too. If people want to work with you, if they want to learn from, you know, more and more about metabolic flexibility, what are some services and courses and things like that that you offer?
Yeah, so the main one for metabolic flexibility is through the Flex Diet, which is at flexdiet.com, FlexDiet.com. And that's 8 different interventions, primarily on nutrition and recovery, everything from protein, fats, carbohydrates, talk a little bit about ketones, fasting, NEAT, exercise, micronutrition, and sleep. And it's organized in the context, like we talked about. So there's a module on the big picture of metabolic flexibility and flexible dieting, hence the title Flex Diet. And then there's a 1-hour technical primer on each one, from protein, carbohydrates, all the ones we listed. And then each one has 5 specific action items. So they know what to do. There's a system of how to figure out which one it is. So you get a big picture, you get the context, you get all the technical information, and then you get the specific action items that you would do. Then we have lots of cool interviews from protein, from like Dr. Stu Phillips, Jose Antonio, flexible dieting, Dr. Eric Helms, sleep, Dr. Dan Party, Dr. Stephen Guillenet, talking about appetite regulation. So I have a lot of other expert interviews there too. So that's at flexdiet.com. And then we've got the Physiologic Flexibility Cert, which just launched again. And that's looking at more of recovery metrics, I would say. Things like breathing, cold exposure, heat exposure, high blood glucose, low blood glucose. I did a pretty deep dive on ketogenic diets and all the different individual ketones and their different effects. And that's at Physiologic Flexibility Cert. And you can get that also. More information on those is primarily through the newsletter, because each of those are only open quarterly. If you go to flexdiet.com, FlexDiet.com, there'll be a wait list there. Just click on that, and that'll put you onto the newsletter. And just hit reply there and tell me you listen to the show, and we'll send you a free gift also.
Sounds good. Yeah, I'll also make sure to link to your social media and website and
oh, thank
all
you.
This stuff in the show notes too.
Awesome.
Yeah. All right, Dr. Mike, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. Maybe we can have you on again some point in the future.
Yeah, anytime. Thank you so much. I appreciate all the good questions and always good to chat with you.
Yeah, good catching up. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in once again. I know I'm going to go back and listen to this episode and take even more notes. So always a pleasure having Dr. Mike on, and I will catch you guys next time. Thank you.